Gilbert Sandro, Dr. Carl's joining us as he does every single Thursday at 11. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Dr. San. How are you today?
Very good. Very happy to see you once again and take lots of science questions. 1-300-055-36 is the number. If you've got one for us, we'd love to hear from you. And there are so many people with so many great questions. We're going to dive straight into it and head first to Byron Bay, where Erin's on the line. Good morning, Erin.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning,
what's your Dr. question?
Erin.
Well, my question is maybe a little bit broad, but I was wondering what is the function of our species in the Earth's ecosystem, especially considering that after Chernobyl, the greatest irony is that life has come back in great abundance because people aren't living there. So where do we fit in as a species?
Evolution doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be good enough. And there's no reason for anything in this crazy mixed up wilderness of the universe where the life of two people don't mean a hill of beans, as they say in Humphrey Bogart says in Casablanca. So we just happen to be here, and we humans, who on one hand occupy a very small volume, that is to say all humans could fit into a box 1 kilometer on a side, we have occupied 50% of the potential agricultural land on Earth, taken away from the animals and used it for our own human species. We've tipped the Earth off its axis a tiny amount by shifting water from ice at the southern and northern ends towards the centre. And when we go away from an area, nature comes back. So what's the purpose? But no, I don't think there's any purpose to anything. We're getting deeply philosophical.
You really are.
Yeah, we can't. I don't know that sort of stuff.
Well, we're just an apex predator.
Oh, yeah, we are the apex predator on Earth, apart from bacteria and viruses.
Okay, so maybe that's just our function. We'll just have to leave it at that.
Our function is that we're a predator.
Oh, but also that we get predated by the bacteria and the viruses. They come and eat us. So we might think that we're the highest possible creature on Earth, but really all we do is come up with income tax, weapons of mass destruction and poetry.
Getting deep as the first caller hits the airwaves. Thank you for the call, Erin.
Thank you.
You blow my mind, Erin. Thank you.
Who run the world? Bugs, it sounds like it. Let's go to Coffs Harbour. Braden is on the line. Hey, Braden, what's your question?
Hi, Dr. Braden. Come on down.
Hello, Braden. Sorry about that. I forgot to press the button.
Oh, my God.
Right. Hello. How are we?
Good. What's your question?
So a couple of years back, Red Bull done an experiment where they skydive from like the very edge of the atmosphere.
Ah, yes, that was a redoing of the Kittinger experiment where they got to 300,000 feet or 100, it wasn't 100 kilometres, which is the edge of space, and a guy jumped out of the balloon and apparently got close to the speed of sound and then survived, yes?
Yes. So question is, so that balloon's designed not to obviously pop or burst or anything with the helium in it. What happens when that balloon gets to space? Does it implode? Does it explode? Or
well, you've got the outward push of the helium gas and you've got the inward push of the structural integrity, the elasticity of the rubber.
Yes.
And always, because the molecule of helium is very small, some of it is leaking out. So you end up with the balloon going up to a certain point, expands, and then it just sort of hovers naturally at that altitude with these forces in balance. Then what happens is that the sunlight shines, and over a period of time weakens the balloon, and then it just splits. And this is when they're finished with the balloon. It just splits and bits of it just lie on the countryside. I've actually seen one of these huge balloons being launched, anecdote warning. And so we're about 80 kilometres out of Alice Springs and I saw this dot floating in the sky. And I said, what's that? And everybody said, it's Venus. I said, it can't be. It's too early. I was seeing a balloon from 50 to 80 kilometres away.
Whoa.
When you go actually to see these balloons being launched, they're maybe 300 metres long. What they do is they've got the skin of the balloon, which is thinner than the cling wrap that you put over food that you put into your fridge. You get out there early in the morning, about 3 hours before sunset, and you're just hanging around for dead, dead quiet. And we went out there 3 mornings in a row, and on the third morning, they actually did it. They said, okay, we'll go. At this stage, they then lay out this canvas sheet that has no dust in it, which is about a third of a kilometre long, and they pull out the balloon fabric, which is about a third of a kilometre long. And then there's these two huge B-double semi-trailers full of cylinders of helium gas. And you've got two large large men who are chosen for their mass. They have to be over 100 kilograms. And they grab onto these pipes that are the diameter of your leg and they hang onto them for a few hours. And they start running the helium gas in from the back of the semi-trailers into the balloon. You start off with a little blob that's the size of a tradie van. And then it gets to be the size of a semi-trailer. And at that stage, it lifts up. If at any stage there's any wind, the cling wrap brushes against the grass and cuts open, and you've just thrown away a couple of hundred thousand dollars worth of stuff. And then the thing just goes up and up it goes. And if you can get off the ground without a wind sweeping it on the grass, you're lucky. And then up it goes, and then eventually it comes down and it just lies. And I asked them, what happens to it when it comes down? They said, well, we don't really know. It just sort of falls to the ground, this thing the size of a football field.
Why do they do it?
Because there's a forbidden... Well, hang on. You can run an aeroplane to a certain altitude and then you can have a satellite higher, but there's an area in between where balloons have a very good function where you can get an experiment up really quickly and then get maybe 10 hours of observing and you can get better quality, much better than you can get from an aeroplane, but to put onto a satellite would be like 10 years planning. So you can put up something quickly, relatively quickly and cheaply.
Hey, thanks for the call, Braden.
No worries, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Braden.
More bang for your buck in that answer as well.
Thank you.
I just said, you know, the whole time you were talking, I was just thinking about the Pixar film Up. That was what was going through my brain just then. I'm sure I'm not alone. Let's go to Mackay, where Renee is on the line with a question. Hey, Renee.
Hi, how are you going?
Good. What's your question?
I'm just wondering, well, it happened to me yesterday. I was under a house and I lifted my head up and got hit and I instantly got like a bump or an egg. I'm just wondering, why do you only get that on your head and not any other part of your body?
Good question.
When you bump it or something.
Two reasons. One, when you do bump your head, by the way, were you wearing a baseball cap backwards? I always do that when I go into the roof because it stops the dirt and it keeps the bleeding to a minimum anyway. So handy hint for next time. First problem is that you've got a thin layer, not a thick layer, a thin layer of flesh and skin over a hard bony surface. So any impact means that you're definitely going to burst open some blood vessels as opposed to burst open one or two. You're going to burst open a heap of blood vessels. Secondly, because they're being pushed up against the hard surface. Secondly, there's nowhere else for the blood to go, for the swelling to go internally. Because the skull's in the way. So it has to go outwards. And that's why you end up with the egg. And then gradually over a period of time it resolves. When did it happen, Renee?
About yesterday afternoon-ish.
Okay, right. A good thing to do is to take photographs every day and you'll see it change colour and go from a yellowish straw colour into a dark greenish colour and that's the hemoglobin breaking down. And then you can put this as a series on the wall and people will say, wow, you're changing colour. Make sure you get the photographs done with the same lighting every day.
Your own personal artwork. Thanks so much for the call, Renee.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Let's head to Wollongong now.
Hello.
Hello. Zeke.
Hi.
You got a question for us?
Yes, I do. I have a question about pins and needles. Now, I understand that when the body is exposed to cold conditions, the blood is drawn to the surface of the skin to counteract the drop in temperature, one of the body's many amazing ways of regulating itself. Now, in light of this, when you're unfortunate enough to experience pins and needles, is it better to put hot or cold water on the skin to alleviate the sensation?
Mm. Ah, so firstly, when you're exposed to cold, the blood does not go to the skin.
Sorry?
When you're exposed to cold weather, the blood does not go to the skin.
Oh, it doesn't?
It does the exact opposite. It abandons the skin. So you've got 100,000 kilometres of blood vessels in your skin, and on average, 5% of them are open at any given moment, and this 5% changes from now to now to now. It just keeps on changing all the time. When you're in a sauna at 90 degrees centigrade, 100% of them are open and you are sweating like crazy. And providing you've got enough water in your body to keep on sweating, you will live. The moment you start to get dehydrated, you will die. At the other extreme, if you're in freezing cold, you sacrifice your skin and you can get away with that for about 6 hours and you have very little blood going to the skin and it goes into a sort of semi-frostbitey gangrene-y stage, but you've got 6 hours before you need to get it warm again. But that's different. So you're talking about the pins and needles and relieving it as quickly as possible.
With hot or cold water?
Okay, I would say hot for the following reason. Pins and needles are usually due to compression of a nerve. And then when you relieve the pressure, the nerve then comes back to normal, helped by the blood vessels. If the blood vessels are open, it will come back to normal sooner. I'm just guessing, I'm working this out as I go along. And therefore, if it is warmer, the blood, more blood vessels will be open, and therefore you'll be able to bring the nerve back to its normal condition sooner, I'm guessing.
Thanks for the call, Zeke.
No worries. Thanks, Dr. Zan. Thanks, Dr. Carl.
See you later, Dr. Zeke. I've never even used water to alleviate pins and needles. I just kind of usually, you know, get it in my foot after I've had my legs crossed and just sort of, you know,
you got this dead leg.
Tap my leg on the ground. But I've never thought about water, so that's a good little shortcut. Maybe it will work for you. 1-300-055-36 is the number if you've got a science question for us. Let's go to Dubbo where Jock's on the line. Hey, Jock, what's your question?
G'day, Zan.
Hello.
G'day, Dr. Jock. Carl, how are you going?
Very good, Dr. Jock.
That's a go. I was just ringing up in regards to, you talked about rolling tobacco. You had a question a couple of weeks ago and how they're worse than pre-rolled cigarettes.
Mm.
So I was just wondering, what about e-cigarettes or, so the e-ciggy vaporizer, even though some liquids that are used in those have nicotine in them, which on Weather believes is an addictive chemical.
Okay, the purpose of the e-cigarette...
What harm or health issues does it have?
We don't know yet. We're finding out.
Yeah,
sure. There's a nicotine in there, which of itself doesn't seem to be too harmful. But when you burn it, you make all sorts of other chemicals which are harmful. What
right.
seems to be the problem with the e-cigarettes is the glycol-type chemicals, which are rated for food-grade eating, but not for breathing. And you think, well, surely it'd be okay. Wheat in food is overwhelmingly safe for the vast majority of us, but wheat dust can cause wheat growers' lungs. But if you collect all that wheat dust and then just sort of blob it together with a bit of butter and spread onto a sandwich, no harm at all. Put it into your lungs, it does cause harm. So we're seeing problems coming through now. It does seem to be better, have less harm than smoking a cigarette, but on the other hand, it seems to be, I'm sorry to use this phrase, a gateway drug. So there are people who are getting into smoking only through e-cigarettes, and then from e-cigarettes, then they go on to regular cigarettes, and there are some people who are using it to come back. But there are definite, though minor, health problems. They're not safe, and we'll find out what those problems are as people do the experiment of smoking lots of e-cigarettes.
It's very early days. Thanks for the call, Jock.
Thank you.
Let's head now to Kyle, calling in from Findlay. Hey, Kyle, what's your question?
Just wondering, I've got an air compressor in the back of the ute. It holds 200 litres. Is compressed air in that make the air compressor heavier than what it does if it was empty?
And what pressure does it go to?
120 psi.
Okay, so this is your basic truth. A cubic metre of air weighs 1.25 kilograms. By the way, a cubic meter of helium, of hydrogen, weighs 0.08 of a gram, which is very light. So the air weighs 1.25 kilograms per cubic meter. You've got a fifth of a cubic meter, but you're running it at 8 times atmospheric pressure. So that means you've probably got about just under 2 kilograms extra weight when the tank is full of compressed air as compared to when it's empty. Just remember, 1.25 kilograms per cubic metre at standard pressure.
Okay, and how would humidity in the air affect that?
I keep on getting it wrong whether the water molecules go in between or displace. I think that it's actually less dense. You have oxygen, which is O2, has a molecular weight of 32. You have nitrogen, which is N2, molecular weight of 28. H2O has a molecular weight of 18 and it displaces, it takes the place of oxygen and nitrogen. So therefore having humid air would weigh slightly less if the water molecules displace the oxygen and nitrogen, which I've been told is the right situation. I used to think they went between. I've been told I've been wrong.
Thanks for the call, Kyle.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Kyle.
You.
Let's head to East Doncaster. Jack's on the line with a question. Morning, Jack. What's your question?
Hey. How are you going? So at the moment, I've got some family over in Paris, and they just got the train to London, and it goes underwater. I just want to know how that's built and how the water doesn't sort of just collapse the tunnel.
There's two ways of building tunnels that cross water crossings, and one is you, on land, make hollow concrete cylinders that you then toe out and then just let sink to the bottom, and then you join them together and then you blow out the water. What they did, but that's relatively uncommon, much more common is you have a boring machine which never sees the water. It goes into the chalk, I think it's chalk, maybe 20, 30, 40, 100 metres below the bottom of the English Channel, and it bores through solid rock or chalk all the way through. It doesn't see water. There would be some water coming through. They'd have to pump it out. But it's not actually drilling through water. It's drilling through solid rock with some water coming through, which they pump out.
How deep is that going then?
Don't know how far under the surface it is. It depends on how impervious the rock is, and which then relates to its structural integrity, because they don't want the tunnel to collapse if they've created a void from the overlying weight of water and rock.
It's so impressive, isn't it, Jack?
That we can do that sort of stuff. And they meet up at the end. Oh, I'm so impressed by that too.
Thanks so much for the call, Jack.
Thank you, Dr. Jack.
Also, a beautiful train ride, and you can drink champagne on it too. So.
And it's actually quicker than taking the train.
Heading out to Heathrow, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and it's so much more pleasant.
If you're lucky enough to do it, you should definitely do it. Highly recommend. So let's go to Canberra. Ash is calling. Good morning, Ash.
Dr. Ash.
Good morning there. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
Awesome. It's a bit of a two-part question. And I have a hypothesis, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
Firstly, when you overexert yourself through exercise, I'm wondering what it is that makes you feel nauseous and feel like you want to vomit. I sort of thought that maybe it's either blood rushing away from the stomach to go to the muscles or like a lactic acid buildup.
Ah, what's the exact physiological biochemical pathway? Number one, I don't know. Number two, I reckon you're on the right track. There's a third long-term issue, which is that you weaken your immune system. And so you're incredibly likely to pick up an infectious disease. So when you've got highly trained athletes who are getting ready for something big like a horse race on one case, you've got the horses together, or people who are preparing for the Olympics, they're really scared of anybody with just a mild cold or flu, because the people who have been highly trained have pushed themselves so hard that they'll fall over. My guess is exactly what you said. The lactic acid is one part of it, and the adrenaline that is running through their system as well. I really don't know, but you're dead right. You do feel sick when you push yourself really hard.
Yeah, I always thought, people always say it's a lactic acid, so I just assumed it was that.
Need to chase it up in a peer-reviewed journal. Can somebody find out for us and put it on the at Dr. Carl Twitter thing, DOCTORKARL.
Thanks for the call, Ash.
The other thing, I heard a rumour that potassium-rich foods sort of stop lactic acid buildup. Is that
okay. Once again, we'd have to chase the peer-reviewed literature. And people from organisations such as the Australian Institute of Sport, whose whole life is sports, and any university that has a sports medicine facility, they'd be able to know from their research what the biochemical, physical, physiological pathway is.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Let's head from Ash to Will, 6 years old, Will, calling in from beautiful Balnarring in Victoria. Hi, Will.
Hi, Dr. Will.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
What dinosaur came first?
Big question. Do you know what dinosaur came first?
There were pre-dinosaurs about 230 million years ago, when the oxygen levels back then were about half of what they are today. And so they had hollow bones, and so they'd suck in some of this fairly low level oxygen air into their lungs, extract the oxygen, and then shove the air into their lungs, into their hollow bones, and then another bunch of air would come through, so they could always be extracting the maximum amount of oxygen. They got some sort of weird name. I was reading in Focus magazine. They were smaller creatures. I can't remember their name, but it's around 230 million years ago. I'm sorry, Dr. Will, I failed you on that one.
Thanks for the call anyway, Will.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Will.
Hannah's calling in from Maitland today. Hey, Hannah, what's your question?
Hi, doctors.
Dr. Hannah. How are you going?
Good. What's your question?
So my question is, when someone goes to sleep at night and they wake up and they have a song in their head that they may not have listened to or heard in months, years, or quite a long time, how does that work, even if it's kind of not within your dream or it just gets within your head when you wake up?
So they wake up and then suddenly there's a song that they haven't experienced for a long time.
Yeah. Have you ever had like a song that you just kind of have in your head? And I get it quite often.
Ah, well, I went to a New Scientist brain series of lectures on the weekend, and one of them was about sleep. And we're getting close to understanding why we sleep, and one reason is to get rid of metabolites in the brain. So we open up a whole bunch of spaces inside the brain where fluid can come washing through and remove the metabolites from overnight. These are around the related to the veins. And another reason goes like this. Sleep is the price of plasticity. In other words, your brain can learn new things, and the only reason you can learn new things is because while you're asleep, you're pruning, you're throwing away other stuff that you didn't want to go through, that you didn't want to keep. And so you might have five people having lunch together, and then the next day they meet and they say, oh, did you remember we talked about blah, blah? And four of them will say yes, and the fifth one will say no. And that fifth person has had their brain decide to throw it away during the night.
Brutal.
So in your particular case, your brain is going through this massive organization to simplify the world down. And why it's chosen that song, that bit we don't know. But we know that the brain is pruning memories and throwing away stuff like crazy. And the advantage is that you can learn new stuff. The disadvantage is that you have weird things like you wake up with a song and you don't know where it came from.
Is it possible that Hannah was thinking of that song or like disposing of that song and then woke up in the middle of that and that's why it's stuck in her brain?
Yes. My brother-in-law...
The song's holding on for dear life.
Yeah, my brother-in-law is a pediatric anaesthetist. And so he's very careful that when he puts the kids to sleep that they're not crying because as regular as clockwork, if they go unconscious from the gas at a certain part of crying, when they wake up, they'll continue that exact rest of the cry.
Wow.
And they're halfway through the, ah, and they'll wake up, they continue going. And so what you've got to do is get them to be nice and calm so that when they wake up, they're not crying again, everybody's happy, and then they won't. So with regard to you, I think it's just something that's been dredged up by your brain trying to simplify the world and maybe decided, hey, Hannah, you haven't sung this song enough, you haven't whistled, you haven't skipped down the park often enough, you need to do it again. Mind you, you're probably horizontally in bed, but let's start.
Thanks for the call,
Hannah.
Thank you. Bye. Let's go to Warrawong, where Nikki is on the line. Hey, Nikki.
Hi, Dr. Nikki. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Nikki. Can you turn your radio down in the background so you're listening to us?
Yeah. Thank you. The bedroom.
That's okay. What's your question?
My 7.5-year-old asked me why don't we get goosebumps on our face?
Ah.
I don't understand.
Okay.
We get it on our legs and arms.
We do. Yeah. The traditional reason is that is to make you look bigger back in evolutionary times when we had more hair. So if you come around a corner and there's a killer kangaroo, part of the automatic sympathetic response is that, you know, your pupils get bigger. The blood flow to your skin is reduced so that if you get cut in a fight, you don't bleed. The blood supply to your muscles is increased. And another thing that happens is that all of the erector pili, which are little muscles that pull on what used to be hair follicles in your skin, suddenly go bling, and they're supposed to make your hair on your skin, which you no longer have, instead of lying flat, to poke out and make you look bigger and more fearsome.
Stand on end, is that correct?
Yeah, you're right. Make the hairs stand on end to make you look bigger and more impressive and more scary. And so the other creature will think, I don't want to have a fight with Nikki because Nikki's suddenly just a little bit bigger. But for some reason, this doesn't happen on your face. I've never thought about it until you and your child pointed it out, but you're dead right. So I'm guessing that there are no erector pili, none of these muscles on the hairs on your face to make them go bigger, but I don't know why.
It's an amazing question that she asked. I was astonished. She's got a scholarship, but I'm very proud of her.
Just remember this, Dr. Nikki. It's not the answer that gets you the Nobel Prize. It's the question.
It's amazing. I think that's absolutely amazing because I couldn't answer it.
Thanks for the call, Nikki, and tell her to keep on asking questions.
Yes, so thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
See you later. Let's go to Mitchell, who's in the Navy. Hey, Mitchell.
Hi, doctors.
Are you at sea right now?
No, not at the moment.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to sound so disappointed. But what's your question for Dr. Carl?
Sorry. Well, I've got a good question, though. Yeah, without going into anything too classified, like our missile guidance systems can kind of, like, they use Doppler radar to locate a target, mm-hmm. and then we use a two-inch laser to actually lock on.
Mm-hmm.
And I've recently observed that we were out at sea, and the target was 27 miles away, which is about 27 nautical miles, which is about 31 miles. Is that mm-hmm. correct? Right about that. That actually needs line of sight to actually work. Like, but with the kind of the curvature of the Earth formula, like at 8 inches per mile squared, is that correct?
So what is the drop in the curve of the Earth for each mile you go across, a nautical mile? Well, how much do you drop?
Well, it's 8 inches per mile squared. Oh, not nautical mile, but I worked it out to a mile. So at 31 miles, mm-hmm. it should be 8 inches per mile squared, which is 100 and, I think it works out 195 meters. It should be the drop that we're picking up. We pick up the target with the Doppler radar and the laser, and also the thermal imaging. Like, that kind of needs line of sight too. So I'm just kind of baffled how those systems can work when you need line of sight at that distance.
Okay, so presumably you've got a high antenna so that you can then look around the curve of the Earth. The other formula is the famous 1-2-3 rule, which is that the distance to the horizon, measured in ordinary miles, sorry about the units, is 1.23 multiplied by the height of the observer's eyes above sea level, the height being in feet. So if you're 16 feet, if your eyes are 16 feet above sea level, the square root of 16 is 4. 4 by 1.23 is about 6, 6 miles. 6 miles is about 10 kilometres. So presumably you've got a high tower on the ship so you can peek over the curve of the horizon.
Hey, thanks for the call, Mitchell.
Thank you.
Thanks, mate. 1-300-055-536 is the number to call if you've got a science question. Mitchell was in the Navy, and that is the perfect segue to let you know that next week we have a special guest, Dr. Carl. His name is Nate Byrne, and he is a meteorologist. He was a Royal Australian Navy lieutenant. He spent the last 12 years working as a meteorologist and also an oceanographer in the Navy, and he also is a great science communicator. In fact, he's been doing sort of science shows to outback communities across Australia. And on top of all that, he is the brand new weatherman for ABC News Breakfast. I saw a video of him and he just seemed like such a legend. I thought, let's get him in. So we're going to introduce him to you if you wake up early and watch News Breakfast, or maybe you just like weathermen like me. Oh. I'm obsessed with the weather.
Well, I was a TV weatherman.
Were you?
For a year and a half on a commercial station.
What haven't you done?
I had a baby.
But you'll be the first. Mark my words. When it's possible, you'll be the first to do it.
Arnold Schwarzenegger beat me to it. Bummer.
So Nate Byrne's going to be in next week. As I mentioned, an oceanographer, a meteorologist, and he's going to be taking your science questions. There's plenty to talk about when it comes to the weather. It is not just small talk. So he'll be joining us next week. Right now it's just Carl. Not just.
Yes.
But, you know, front and centre, 1-300-055-536 if you've got a question for him. Christy does calling in from Riddles Creek. Hey, Christy.
Hi, Christy.
Hey. How you going?
Good. Welcome. What's your question?
About laser hair removal, what are the risks and how exactly does it work?
Now, I haven't read up on it, but the way it works, having spoken to a few people when we had a discussion about over tea, seems to be that it burns the individual hair follicle and just damages the machinery on your skull. 100,000 hairs, 100,000 hair follicles. Each hair follicle slowly exudes one hair. And on your leg, similar situation. So you've just got to go around and zap each hair follicle. And then it goes into a, I'm being killed, inflammation, bumpy, and sometimes necrosis and little sores and everything. I think that's the way it works. I'm going to have to read up on that one. That's as much as I got. Sorry, Dr.
Is it dangerous, though?
If it's okay, this is where it gets tricky. You're using quite powerful lasers. And the lasers, and this is where the talk arose because I was talking with medical doctors. When they're using these lasers, they have to go through a special training course. Then lasers of the same strength, in some cases, are handed over to unqualified people. And you, as an innocent consumer, go into the shop and you think they know what they're doing. And they don't.
And you can buy them on eBay as well. So you can buy them in shaver shops, everything. You can go buy your own laser hair removal. So it sounds a bit risky.
It could be. Look, just keep away from the small tactical nuclear devices and the lasers and you should be right.
Thanks for the call, Christy.
Thank you.
I've always wondered how it works as well.
I'll have to read up on that one as well.
Jacob's calling in from Perth. Hey, Jacob.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I was wondering if free energy can be created by magnets, and why are we not using them today?
Free energy. You
can't get free energy from magnets. So you're looking at a magnet, and the magnet's on the fridge, and it's holding up, you know, a reasonable sort of weight, maybe, you know, 50 grams, 100 grams, if it's a really powerful magnet, maybe even half a kilogram. And how come it's doing all this work? It's not doing any work at all. In physics, the formula runs like this. Work equals force, and there is a force, by the distance covered. There is no distance being covered. The weight is at the same distance from the fridge day in and day out. It's not doing any work. You start making it do work and then the magnet will get weaker. So you're not getting free energy from a magnet.
Hey, thanks for the call, Jacob. Let's go to Graham calling in from Scoresby. Hey, Graham.
Hey, hiya.
Good. Hi. What's your question?
I just want to know that if, like, you're on a plane and all the water and the food are on a plane, and you fly to, say, Brisbane, and all the water and food have been consumed by the passengers, does the plane still weigh the same at takeoff and landing, or is it different?
Okay, so we're ignoring anything to do with the fuel. We're just talking about the food in and out.
Food and water, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so on a typical flight from across the Pacific, there'll be a loss of 800 kilograms of water from the passengers, which then goes out into the outside air. So you have air being compressed in the engines and then filtered and then being shoved into the aeroplane in zones maybe 3 or 4 seats deep, you know, from back to front along the length of the plane. So you have zone 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and it goes along the plane. And then the air comes out carrying extra water vapor from the people and then leaves the plane. There are little valves. If they had them completely shut, the plane would expand. If they had them completely open, everybody would die. They're just sort of at a stage in between. You're eating food. And so the food comes out of your mouth the way it came in as carbon dioxide and water. Carbon dioxide has a molecular weight of 44, so it's higher than oxygen or nitrogen. So the plane gets lighter because you're losing both carbon dioxide and the water vapor. And by the way, we're just pretending that the fuel loss is not being counted.
Love that question, though. Thanks for the call, Graham.
No worries.
Thank you.
Let's go to Williamstown. Matt's on the line. Good morning, Matt. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
My question has to do with Dion Brehm book by the name of Lost Symbol, where they do an experiment to measure the soul.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to know if there's any legitimate experiment that exists that they're able to measure something like that.
Never been done. The 2003 movie called 21 Grams starts off with a statement that is both compelling and wrong, and I'll quote, "They say we all lose 21 grams at the exact moment of death." Completely wrong. Based on experiments by Dr. Duncan McDowell in Massachusetts in the year 2007, where he got a bunch of people who were dying of wasting diseases like tuberculosis rather than So that, the advantage of that was that instead of sort of thrashing around at the moment of death, they sort of go, aha, I go, fare thee well. And he had them on scales that he reckoned could measure down to a tenth of an ounce. And he had these patients, and then he published his results saying at the moment of death, the scales showed a loss in weight of 3/4 of an ounce, which is 21 grams, which is how that came into existence, that myth. And then it got picked up by the New York Times a little bit later. Three problems with that experiment. Experiment number one, he had a sample size of 6 patients. Way too small. If you're testing this cola versus that cola, if 8 out of 10 say there's a difference, it's not significant, but if you double that to 16 out of 20, it is. So 6 is too small a sample size. Problem number two, let's look at his 6 patients. One of his patients did in fact register a loss of weight at the moment of death of 21 grams. Patient number two lost weight and then gained it again. Patients number 3 and 4 were excluded because of problems, and patients 5 and 6 had other problems. So he had 6 patients of whom 1 gave the result he wanted and then he kept it. And in problem number 3, how on earth do you tell the exact moment of death? Even today, with our massive technologies, we still have difficulty in seeing if they're dead. So the heart might have stopped, but the brain is still pumping out electricity. How do you know the moment of death? And finally, if the soul has weight, then you would expect the body to become lighter as the soul escaped. In fact, you expect the soul to sort of fall onto the ground. you know, it sort of dribbles out of the body and goes clunk on the ground. But don't they go to the heavens in the movies? So it's totally wrong. We have never proven the existence of a soul. Doesn't mean we won't, but so far we've had zero success.
So that 21 grams relates to what, oxygen in their lungs?
No, that was the what was measured by Dr. Duncan McDowell. I'll give you the exact quote. Here he goes. The bed was, this is from my 23rd book, arranged on a light framework built upon very delicately balanced platform beam scales. And he said at the end of 3 hours and 40 minutes, he expired, and suddenly, coincident with death, the beam dropped and with an audible stroke hitting against the lower limiting bar, and it remained there with no rebound. The loss was ascertained to be 3/4 of an ounce, unquote. Exact quote from his scientific paper.
Thanks for the call, Matt.
Thank you.
Do you hope that your soul dribbles out of you or raises to the heavens when you die?
I would rather hope that the good that I do lives on behind me. And so rather than leaving behind a dead body and worrying about the soul, that I'll have left some better things in the world behind me.
Yeah, we're all just bodies. We're all just vessels. Abby is calling in from Torquay. We're getting very heavy towards the end of this.
And the beginning too.
But maybe Abby can bring us back down to earth.
Come on, Abby.
Hello, Abby.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
I was just wondering, is there any proofs or any paperwork on, is all these food allergies that are presenting themselves now that we know of, are they because we are living our lives differently? Women are eating different things when they're pregnant that they probably wouldn't have, you know, many, many years ago when you just, are we sort of weaker specimens now because of our lifestyle changes?
Is it environmental in terms of allergies for, you know, lactose intolerance, gluten intolerance, Dr. Carl?
Yeah, are they sort of being created by us?
Okay,
as
well,
humans?
Okay. Number one, peanut allergies are increasing in the West, but not in China. In China, they use peanut oil like crazy, and they love it the way it is and has been for thousands of years. And so they do the old-fashioned way of cooking the peanuts for a long time at a low temperature. No peanut allergies in China. Over in the West, we've tried to save some money and cook them at a really high temperature for a short period of time, and there has been an increase in peanut allergies, almost certainly due to the way the peanuts are prepared. Gluten intolerance, 8 out of every 1,000 people, and yet 280 have been convinced by marketing that they should go for gluten-free food.
But the industrialization of food surely has had a big impact on the way that we digest.
Sure. Yes, it changes that. And there's also the what effect it has upon the microbe. That is such a deep question, Abby. I think we'll have to run that past our good friend, Professor Claire Collins.
Unfortunately, we are running up towards the news, so that's where we have to leave it. But thank you for the call, Abby.
No worries. Thank you very much.
And we will have Professor Claire Collins in again, who is our wonderful nutritionist and professor of dietetics friend from the University of Newcastle, talking all about food, because obviously that is a whole other hour to fill. Mm. Next week, we're going to be talking about oceanography, about meteorology, about the world around us, about climate. Nate Byrne is the brand new weatherman for ABC News Breakfast, and we've invited him in to join you. So make sure that you start thinking of some great weather and ocean questions. He'll definitely be able to help you out. We'll see you then, Dr. Carl.
Very much so.